It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up later in the program, tracing illegal guns in the Pittsburgh area and why it's so easy for teens to get their hands on them. Plus, the two Pittsburghs, the impact of disparities in everything from access to transportation to prenatal care, to contact with the criminal justice system. But first...
And so we find ourselves asking the same questions we ask in other cities in transition. Are the new arrivals, new money, new ideas, saving the city or cannibalizing it? Who will live in the Pittsburgh of the future? And will there be room for the people who stayed true, stuck with it their whole lives?
Joining us in studio to talk about Pittsburgh's latest, maybe unwanted national spotlight, journalist Brenton Mock, staff writer for City Lab, an online subsidiary of the Atlantic family, covering urban development. Good to have you here, Brenton.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
And the associate editor and restaurant critic for Pittsburgh Magazine, Hal B. Klein. Welcome, Hal.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're invited to join the conversation. Tweet your questions or comments. Use the hashtag, please, WESA Confluence. Okay, last Sunday, Pittsburgh was featured on CNN, not for its self-driving cars or its climate agreement or its pitch to Amazon, but on a food exploration show. Celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain's TV series, Parts Unknown, is in its 10th season and on the news network. In his 40-minute program, Bourdain travels to cities and countries all over the world, eating his way through local culture and cuisine. So, Brenton and Hal, what were your initial impressions of Bourdain's visit to Pittsburgh? Brenton, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I didn't see it when it aired live. I saw it a few days later, but I saw the social media reactions after it aired live. And people had some bad feels about it. And when I finally got a chance to watch it, I actually didn't think it was as bad as what I read and what I saw on social media. If anything, I think he might have been too kind to Pittsburgh. I don't know. What did you think, Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a pretty honest assessment, and it was nice to see something. I think Pittsburgh food in particular has gotten a lot of national media attention, and it seems to be something that's very celebratory and something that people come in for a couple of days and maybe they've heard about some things. And it was nice to see a show that really spent a lot of time researching, came in and asked some hard questions, even if maybe there were things that were in the episode that didn't make us feel great the entire time. I think it's important to have that conversation. It's important to see that.
Was there any social media saying that it was, you know, that said, you know, you got it right on. You nailed it. Did any of you spot that? Either of you spot that?
On my timeline, yeah. I mean, there were a few voices that, like, I think kind of like me, didn't understand why everyone was so angry with Anthony Bourdain. Because, as Hal said, I think that it was, for the most part, a pretty accurate or at least honest portrayal of Pittsburgh. We may not like to see all of the city and all of its warts and all put out in the national spotlight like that, but that's the reality that exists, and Bourdain was not wrong for illuminating that.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that it was really mixed. You know, I think at first, I think there's this excitement, right? Because it's Parts Unknown, it's going to air, it's Pittsburgh. And so I think there's this buildup and people are really expecting something. And so there was that first kind of like stomach blow almost. And then after that, people started to really think about it and assess what happened and look at the show with maybe a little bit more perspective.
The show opens sort of with a romantic picture of Pittsburgh. People dancing to an accordion, bocce. Older Italian men in Bloomfield, sausages and peppers. But then a storm rolls in and the tone of the show begins to change. In fact, Bourdain even asks, is this an augur of doom?
Well, first, let me say I'm so happy to finally watch a show about Pittsburgh food that's not focused on putting French fries in sandwiches. that was a really welcome thing.
Cheers for
me.
That. Yeah. Yes, that was great.
But I will also say that opening in Bloomfield, that entire cultural scene of the men playing bocce, that was a part of Pittsburgh that was unknown to me. And I was born here. I didn't live here my entire life, but I lived here at least 2/3 of my life. And so I was actually very appreciative of that opening.
Yeah, I like that I live in Bloomfield and I'm familiar with the bocce court. And I like that they really went in and really looked at a lot of different parts of Pittsburgh instead of just a kind of very specific, you know, foodie, whatever that is, perspective.
Right.
Right.
And to get that Italian culture that's been around for a long time, that's such a part of that neighborhood.
Right.
You mentioned, both of you, that a lot of people have been really angry about the portrait that followed. So why do you think people are upset? What have you been hearing as you talk about this? And let's face it, even Mayor Peduto told the Post-Gazette this week that he forgot to, quote, DVR it and hasn't found the time since then. So what have you been hearing?
I mean, I think one thing, and I think this is sort of a fair perspective, is that some of the contemporary stuff that's happening in food maybe was not given as much of a spotlight. Sometimes in Bourdain shows, there's a lot of these really glamorous, exciting food shots. And this episode definitely missed some of that. So there wasn't until, you know, there was a little bit at the Italian barbecue that they did. And then there was a little bit at the end with Kevin Sousa. You know, there's some beautiful shots of him kind of stripping some fish and drying some fish skin. But I think maybe people wanted to see a little bit more of what was happening with that.
Yeah. And what have you heard, Brent?
I mean, obviously there's the tension of the big G word, gentrification, that was definitely touched upon. And, you know, it was this age-old tension, right, between who are these people who are colloquially known as the old Yinzers versus the new hipsters. And I think, you know, there's a couple of things, right? I mean, one, this is not a new thing. I mean, even the term hipster and the people who we call hipsters, they're not some invention that happened in the 21st century. These are people who existed in the 40s and 50s. The exact same resentment existed back then. These were people who, the hipsters of the 40s and 50s, these were people who extracted themselves from the traditional labor class that Pittsburgh prided itself on, right? They said, we're not going to work in the coal mines of our fathers and grandfathers. We're interested in culture and arts and music and food, civil rights, gender rights. And I think today, when you look at that resentment that was illuminated in Bourdain's show, it was just showing that that resentment obviously has not gone away, if for no other reason that, you know, in many ways, traditional labor lost, right? I mean, Pittsburgh right now is crafted in the mold of the creative class, the tech class, the knowledge class, and it markets its future in that kind of way. So you can obviously understand why you would see that kind of resentment from people who might consider themselves part of the traditional labor class, which they see as the traditional Pittsburgh. And it would be hard to swallow a narrative like the one that Bourdain showed.
Yeah, I mean, there was a really powerful moment in the segment on the Hill where they talk about the demolition of the Lower Hill, and they're driving by where the Stanley Cup is happening, and Saladin says they don't even know the pain that this playground caused.
Right.
And I thought that was a really powerful moment. And it's hard to hear that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, when do you get to talk about race within that context, right? Because whether we're talking about the 40s and 50s or whether we're talking about today, African Americans didn't have a good shake in either of those economies, right? I mean, some of them had jobs in the coal mines and the steel mills, but they were not the owners of production. They were not the managers. They were at the lower levels of the labor class. And just like today, they are being excluded from the new economy. They don't have the Google jobs and the Uber jobs. So, you know, if we can't bring it up on Bourdain's show, when do we get to talk about race and racism and exclusion?
Brenton and Hal, you both have said that Bourdain could have hammered this point regarding the Hill District and the construction of the then Civic Arena and what that did to displacing so many residents from the Lower Hill, that he could have hammered that point a little harder if he wanted to, including the building of Three River Stadium, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, in a show that's 44 minutes long, it's making editorial decisions and it's doing it. And I think just like you said, I mean, even the fact that this was brought up in a show and that conversation happened was so important. And it was really, I remember watching that segment in particular and feeling really affected by it and thinking that that was a thing that I didn't think about as much as I should.
Right. I mean, that was one segment, right, on the Hill District, an even shorter segment on East Liberty and the neighborhood change that Pittsburgh has seen on that, and people were still irate with the show. So, I mean, if we can't dedicate, 10, 15 minutes out of a 45-minute show to this very real phenomenon, then again, when do we get to talk about these things?
Right. He could have mentioned the East Liberty reference very briefly.
It was very pedestrian.
And and it could have, you know, focused a bit on the controversy over the Penn Plaza apartments and the gentrification issue there. I want to go back to a little bit more about food. I kind of found it, I don't know, a nice mix of the old traditional food culture and some and a handful of new restaurants, whether they be the Cure, the Spoon, whatever. Now, Hal, you were an advisor consultant?
I wouldn't go that far, but they
okay.
they did a really really strong job with their research, and they reached out to a bunch of people. I was included in that. And
so you were a consultant.
I have on that special thanks at the closing credits, which I didn't realize when I saw it, and then someone sent me a screenshot, so that was exciting.
Okay, so but the point is, what did you expect to see regarding the food scene, the restaurant scene, and what you actually did see?
So I liked that there was the juxtaposition. I think the one thing that I found missing was that there wasn't this sort of gray spot in between a place like Apteka, which is a restaurant in Bloomfield that is run by someone who is a multi-generational Pittsburgher whose family comes from Poland, and then someone whose parents were Polish born. And so it's really rooted in this working class traditional Pittsburgh culture, but it's also very new. It's hip. It's a vegan restaurant. The cocktails are all made from foraged ingredients. So I wanted to see a little bit more of that kind of tie together. And then I think just from a food perspective, Squirrel Hill has these really wonderful regionally specific Chinese restaurants. And the region that the reason that that's happening is related to education in a lot of ways, in that a lot of students and professors are coming over from China and letting restaurants have food from Sichuan province, from northern China, from Taiwan. And I would have liked to have seen a little bit of that just because it's something that I think is really important in Pittsburgh food right now.
Okay. With the restaurant scene, this was one of the first times we've seen Superior Motors chef Kevin Sousa talk about sort of the mistakes he made leading up to his latest venture in Braddock. Sousa says, "I learned from this." And that was also a part of the Braddock segment.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk to Sousa. I want to bookmark that, though. I want to talk about the restaurant and food scene and how something that I hope that Bourdain will go into, which is that the way that we talk about food in Pittsburgh is very racially exclusionary, right? I mean, when we center on the kielbasa and the sauerkraut and the pierogies and the, you know, the French fries and the sandwich, while these are kind of culinary treats that probably Pittsburgh residents of all races eat, these are not African American traditional foods. And so with the other segments, he went into these other neighborhoods and looked at how they ate from home, you know, from Braddock all the way to Bloomfield. But, you know, we go in the Hill District and, yeah, they ate a Grandma B's, but there was not a conversation about the food. We don't even know what they ate. I mean, really,
we didn't even really see the people that work there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, it's so if there was a one of the faults I would say is that, you know, the story of Black Pittsburgh kind of does get reduced to being wiped out because of what happened with the building of the Civic Arena in the Hill District. But we still don't have a way of talking about how African-Americans eat food, because the kinds of foods that are featured are not traditional African-American treats.
So it was a reflection. Yeah. We had a reflection of some traditional foods, as you alluded to, Italian and others, and East European, but not African-American.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, you go to Braddock, you know, this city, that is one of the many municipalities that has been kind of wiped away as the steel industry has come to its demise. And we focus on Kevin Sousa as being the saving grace for Braddock. But I don't think that there was a very robust conversation about the economics of that, about whether African-Americans, how they will be able to generate wealth, whether in Braddock or in Pittsburgh, from these kinds of discussions.
On his website, Bourdain ate at Grandma B's a sandwich and fries, and that's the least specific description on the site. So I think that emphasizes your point, Burton.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that.
I mean, okay, I want to go, by contrast, you had Justin Severino of Cure. He made it clear he wasn't thinking about the neighborhood. He's in Upper Lawrenceville that had the cheapest rent. So he wasn't thinking about the neighborhood. So that's where he moved in. It could be editing, it could be oversimplification, but how do omissions like this sort of fuel Pittsburgh's growing narrative around gentrification?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think part of it probably was editing. I think there was probably something, you know, and they needed someone to say, you know, because in that scene there was the juxtaposition of Sonia saying, "I care," and then having Justin being like, you know, "Well, I didn't. I just did this thing." And I think, you know, I haven't talked to him about this, but I get the sense of what he was trying to say was just like, "I'm just trying to open a restaurant, and I wasn't thinking about all the big picture." But it's tough with gentrification because it's, you know, how do you run a small business? How do you find a place where you're just starting and you can afford? So you have to remember now, you know, he's a national media darling. He gets all the attention. People talk about him. But when he opened Cure, that wasn't the case at all. You know, he was someone that was coming back to town that had some pedigree, but wasn't, you know, necessarily someone that was going to be this huge restaurant presence per se. But I think to not be aware of the neighborhood you're moving in and to not understand the consequences of what might happen 1 year, 3 years, 10 years down the road is something that you should always think about, something like that, when you're opening a business.
Okay. One more, and I wanted to quickly get in the fact that Bourdain asserts that Pittsburgh's growing thanks to the booming tech industry, but then Braddock filmmaker Tony Buba calls him on it, said Pittsburgh's not growing. Of course, U.S. Census figures show that estimates that Pittsburgh's population actually has gone down the last 4 years. Buba asserts people are coming to Braddock for the experience. I guess maybe, what, a bucket list? I went to Braddock. Isn't that cool? And I ate something there.
Yeah, I mean, he had a very specific reference. He said that they come in to get the Wire experience, which is, of course, an allusion to the HBO show about inner city Baltimore. I think that that's a very real aspect of gentrification that's not spoken about a lot, where these people are kind of parachuting in. They want to experience the roughness, the grittiness, and all of that. But then they go back to wherever they come from, and that becomes the limitations of their experience with a place like Braddock or even a place like the Hill District.
I do think with something like that, though, that and I really love his films, but I think it was a bit overstated. I think people are going because the Brew Gentlemen brew good beer and have fun events, and people want to go. And I don't think it's necessarily a voyeuristic thing.
It does bring some dollars into the local economy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a good follow-up question of, you know, how are they going to be good citizens and good neighbors in the neighborhood? But I don't think that people are going to the Brew Gentlemen just to have some sort of, you know, Wire experience. I think they're going to drink beer and eat food at food trucks.
Okay, we're quickly running out of time. Just have about a minute and a half left. I want to ask you about the final scenes in New Alexandria. We've already seen rock shows and wrestling. How does Demolition Derby in a rural western Pennsylvania town inform what the outside world should think of Pittsburgh?
So there was a woman in that scene who was wearing a Confederate flag hoodie jacket.
There were a bunch of Confederate
flags. Flags, right? Yeah. And so, you know, for me, just, I mean, real quickly, it was not discussed. It was not brought up. You know, why is a city in a state that was part of the Union prominently still featuring this kinds of signs and flags? You know, I think those are the kinds of ways that race was glossed over in Bourdain's show. And it's also the kind of way that we gloss over race when we talk about Pittsburgh in general.
Yeah, I mean, the whole scene, I get why they did it, but it felt out of context. It wasn't really framed in any way. It was just, and now we're here. And I think that could have been, I think that segment might have been a nice time to kind of tie it up and ask some more questions and do things instead of showing the segment that was just suddenly we're, you know, 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh.
Right.
And
it was referenced that Pennsylvania turned red for Donald Trump.
Yeah, but that was in the segment before.
Yeah.
In Braddock with Mayor Fetterman,
right,
who actually talked about that. You know, he kind of contextualized it and framed it, and then suddenly we're just here in this demolition derby in this. You know,
was that
thing
emphasizing that point?
Well, possibly. It never came up. I mean, at least not in the New Alexandria part. I mean, it
other
was never
than the symbolism of Confederate.
Right, we saw it, but we didn't hear the people of New Alexandria actually take account for their views, at least from a racial perspective.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so very much. Brenton Mock is a staff writer for City Lab, a product of The Atlantic magazine. Hal B. Klein is associate editor and restaurant critic for Pittsburgh magazine. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, the seeming lack of transparency about illegal guns seized in the Pittsburgh area. Where are they coming from? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A new report looking at marijuana arrests found Black Pennsylvanians were 8 times more likely to be arrested for possessing the drug than their white counterparts. The ACLU is calling for the state to legalize pot. And forecasters say to expect a warmer than average winter. Though Pennsylvania will likely see higher temperatures, the Pittsburgh region is also expected to have a wetter than normal winter. Find more top news at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Since 2012, Pittsburgh police have recovered, confiscated more than 3,600 guns from suspects. It appears that more than two-thirds of those were owned illegally. I use the word appears because the city has not been completely forthcoming with data about seized weapons. So how big of a problem is it? Do we even know because of a seeming lack of transparency? And will knowing the extent even help reduce the illegal gun market? Joining us to talk about his reporting on illegal guns is Jeff Benzing from Public Source. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
According to the Pennsylvania Uniform Crime Report, compiled by state police, there were more than 35,000 crimes involving firearms in Pennsylvania last year, including two-thirds of the 884 homicides. So, Jeff, there is some information being collected, but is it enough information, or is it just the access to the information, or both?
Right. So basically what we know is that there are plenty of gun crimes in the state and also in Pittsburgh. I mean, if you look at each year, you know, you have several hundred shootings, fatal and non-fatal, in the city of Pittsburgh. Some of those are sort of perpetrated by guns that were purchased legally. You know, you go to the store, you get mad, you use the gun that has your name on it, basically. Others are firearms that have been trafficked. So those are guns that are passed from hand to hand, maybe traded for drugs, getting into the hands of pretty young folks in the city. I spoke with prosecutors talking about guns in the hands of 12-year-olds. And that's what we're sort of looking at here, trying to quantify the number of guns or the general sense of how many of these guns are carried illegally.
With what cooperation you've received, what do you feel you have a good handle on what we know about illegal guns in the Pittsburgh area?
Basically, what we know is that it's a problem. It's a problem, and that not much attention has been paid to either informing the public or really within the department trying to figure out, here's how we can analyze our data. Here's what we know about the sources of guns and working back from there. They told me that they didn't keep their search results in a spreadsheet. It was basically case-by-case basis. And that means that it's difficult to disseminate information to the public or to journalists like me. And it's also difficult maybe to do some analysis internally unless you have that together. So we know it's a problem. The question is how big. That's something that really warrants work on their part and maybe work in terms of journalists in the city as well.
So the police bureau might not be digging deep enough into their own data that they have?
It appears that they are not doing too much with their search results. So the federal government, the ATF, does searches on behalf of basically any police department in the country. And certainly the ATF has that data, and they work with the police. So it's not as if there's nothing. But I sat down with officers from the Trace Unit in the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police earlier this year, and they said, you know, I was just asking them if they had data because I wanted to see what they might be able to give me or what I could get. And they said they didn't keep it in a database.
In your reporting, you mentioned that early on, originally you were getting cooperation from the police bureau, but what sort of happened?
Well, so it started slowly, basically. I had asked for data on origins of firearms, which is something they said was prohibited under federal law to hand out.
Is that true?
It's true depending on how detailed it is. Chicago and New York State have given have created pretty robust reports looking really pretty fine in at the origins of illegal firearms, going down right to the gun store in Chicago, for instance. You know, that's something that the government itself did, so that's different than giving it to a journalist like me. But they sort of said, you know, we can't give you anything. We can't even give you a total of the number of firearms that were searched, which I was able to get you know, within a couple of days from city of Philadelphia, a couple other cities and boroughs in Western Pennsylvania, Wilkinsburg, Mount Oliver.
Why them and not Pittsburgh?
Unclear. And I told them that I had received data from others and they didn't really cite any particular roadblocks. And it was a slow process. I eventually was able to get data not on traces, but on guns that were seized, which is sort of the same universe. But we're looking at here are guns that were sort of logged in evidence as being picked up. And then later it'll be traced by the ATF and also the state police as part of that process. So I was able to get that. And then was told that they had given me too much information and that I should destroy the database that they gave me, which we didn't do, but also in sort of trying to get some questions answered by the Bureau themselves, they had just ended up sending us a bunch more data anyway, seemingly not with an issue. So they sort of asked us to destroy something and then kind of restored it later on. But it's a process.
Is it because they hadn't filtered out certain information, the illegal guns versus legally owned guns that were used in a suspected crime?
It wasn't that. What they had given me was really everything they had picked up and had explained that. So it was guns that someone turned in because they didn't want anymore.
Okay.
And then anything from a firearm that was picked up in a DUI stop to something that may be tied to a fatal shooting or something like that. And so my job was basically to filter those out. But what they had given me that they thought was a problem was basically more details on those cases, on the firearms themselves, saying it was investigative in nature and shouldn't be out there.
We can talk about numbers, but let's put a face on. What does this illegal gun market look like? You were talking to teenagers for your stories.
Mm-hmm. I would say that the main point to get across here is that this is a problem that is both bigger than people realize and it's also smaller than people realize. You know, you're not walking the streets of Pittsburgh and every teenager is, you know, has a revolver stuffed in their pocket, right, and they're going to pull it on you and you're going to get, you know, you're in danger. That's not true. However, the access to firearms for those who want them and, you know, even just for protection, to protect themselves. They're not trying to go stick up, you know, grandma down the street or anything like that. They're quite easy to get if you have a connection and you have a couple hundred dollars. You could trade drugs for it. You could have a friend buy it for you, a girlfriend, a boyfriend. There's a researcher at Duke University named Phil Cook, and he described it basically as being like, you're a teenager and you're trying to get beer. You find someone who's 21 who can buy beer for you. And that's how easy it would be to get a firearm if you're underage here. I mean, it costs a little more money and maybe right, there's a little more at stake. But it's not like illegal drugs where you have to find a source of drugs and someone's trafficked them from, you know, crossing borders and that sort of thing. There's stores pretty available. You just have to have someone to get one for you.
Speaking of sort of conduits for access to guns, 2008, Pittsburgh adopted an ordinance requiring gun owners who know that their guns are lost or stolen to report to police within a certain time frame. That ordinance has not been enforced, really out of fear of NRA-backed lawsuits, and these cities and municipalities can't afford the legal cost to do so. So the ultimate question, where do these guns come from, and how can we trace the source of those guns?
Mm-hmm. They come from anywhere. I mean, they're coming from here in Allegheny County. They're not being trafficked from, you know, far across the country, which is the case in some areas. In New York, New York State, they basically said the attorney general did a report and he put Pennsylvania in what was termed as the iron pipeline as being a source of guns that are ending up at their crime scenes. They're crossing borders to get there. Talked with the district attorney, Stephen Zappala, as I was doing the story, and he said, you know, there's not really any reason to leave Allegheny County if you want a firearm. You'll be able to get it. You know, the access is there. It's whether or not you have someone to get it for you.
The Confluence talked to Shannon Williams of Ceasefire Pennsylvania. She says it's necessary to gather the data about illegal guns and why that data could be important.
There are no illegal gun manufacturers, right? Like, there's no bootleg gun manufacturers. So having an understanding of where these guns are coming from, like how they're circulating through the city, how they're getting from becoming from being legal to illegal is important.
You've talked with Shannon as well. Your take on what she had to say.
Right. Well, what you really want to know is, if there are specific sources of guns, you know, say firearms are being sold illegally from a particular gun store, which federal agents say is actually fairly rare. Most stores are kind of on the up and up, but they also shut down a local store this summer who was selling guns basically for cash, no background check. You would want that known. You would be able to make that public, maybe put some pressure, have some transparency. But the maybe bigger issue is to show that there are a ton of sources here. These are guns that are coming in from the suburbs, someone stealing from their neighbor, from their family. Again, it's very closely tied to the drug problem that we have here. They're sort of used as currency. And why I talked to Shannon is that she's been trying to figure out origin information for Pittsburgh firearms that are illegally carried for years. Starting in 2013 is when she began. And the city was cooperating. They were working with her and then essentially said, the data we gave you is wrong, didn't explain or correct it really, and said, we can't give you anything more. So she wasn't able to do to put out a report that she had done for half of 2014. Meanwhile, places like Chicago put out really detailed reports, New York State, and it's sort of been a nightmare since then trying to get data as a journalist. And I know that they have also had issues of their own at Ceasefire PA trying to do sort of their advocacy side of it.
Say you get the data that you're looking for. Is it going to do much good about illegal guns? Aren't there just enough guns just to fill in any gap that might take place?
It's a starting point. Essentially, it shows we have a problem. This is something that needs resources and needs to be paid attention to. It's no secret that guns are getting on the street and getting into the hands of young people, teenagers, 11, 12, 13 years old. And they're being used. They're being used to settle feuds, things that are just, you know, maybe it would be a schoolyard fight. We have teenagers that are armed and seemingly willing to use firearms. And so what needs to be done is an understanding of how big the problem is. Study if there are sources that maybe could be clamped down on, if law enforcement could respond more efficiently, or if certain things happen, we made a change here because we could see how it moved. And right now, there's just no transparency. There's no way to tell.
You mentioned Chicago and New York State have issued robust reports on illegal firearms, but have those actions, have that release of information by Chicago and New York State, has it led to any reforms that reduce the number of illegal firearms or reduce the number of crimes involving firearms?
Well, we know Chicago, of course, had a very violent year last year in terms of their gun homicide problem. And, you know, certainly it's too early to tell, but what they were really pointing out is that there are so many guns that are coming into the city of Chicago from outside sources. You know, that Texas is on their map, for instance. Texas is nowhere near Illinois, and guns are sort of flowing through there. And so what they were trying to do was to show this is a problem here in Chicago, but it has roots kind of in many states, Indiana right next door, for instance, and trying to point out there are other causes of this than what we're doing here in the city of Chicago. I would contrast that to Pennsylvania, though, because our and in Pittsburgh, or Pittsburgh region anyway, our restrictions are not as tight as like they would have in their circumstances. And so we don't have that issue necessarily if you need to get a gun from Texas to commit a crime in the Pittsburgh region. You just sort of cross the border over, you know, the municipal line to the nearest gun shop, and, you know, there's your source.
Jeff, finally, you have another story coming out in this series. What can we look forward to?
Sure. So the Wilkinsburg Borough Police were very helpful in terms of providing us data, I would say, before the city of Pittsburgh did, and also granted us access to follow around some officers in their police department on patrol. And what we wanted to do was look at the impact of illegal firearms in that community, which is often stigmatized as a place of violence and crime, and to see what the real impact is, see what community members and advocates are saying, and also to shine light on some of the progress that they've seen. It's not the Wilkinsburg of 20 years ago. However, you see these sort of the scope of illegal firearms coming in, and you realize there is still work to be done.
Jeff Benzing is a reporter for Public Source, doing a series of reports on the illegal gun market in the Pittsburgh area. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
The reinvention of Pittsburgh has grabbed national attention. It's improved the lives of some, but is that rising tide lifting all boats? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history.
So what you're going to do here is you're going to go down through three stop signs down a road here. Once you get to that third stop sign, go through that stop sign, all right? You're going to come.
Pittsburgh Dad premieres on YouTube in 2011. Created by Chris Pretzka and Kurt Wooten, the blue-collar father is based on Wooten's own dad. He can be seen reacting to Steelers games, giving Pittsburgh directions, and most recently riding the Kennywood Logjammer on its last day. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 27th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. While the city of Pittsburgh continues to court major development, including Amazon's second North American headquarters, there are concerns that not all residents will experience the benefits. That divide is what's been called the two Pittsburghs, and it could widen instead of shrink. WESA this week began a six-part series of reports on some of the inequities confronting the Pittsburgh region. We're going to talk about that with Patrick Doyle, news director for WESA, and reporter covering identity and justice, Virginia Alvino Young. Thanks to both of you for coming here.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
As always, your comments and questions are most welcome. Tweet us and use the hashtag WESA Confluence. Okay, Patrick, in the last year, WESA reporters have done multi-part series on everything from charter schools to lead and water to immigrants. Why inequities is the focus of this series?
Well, I think, Kevin, it's one of the major issues of our time, if not the issue. And it cuts along so many lines in Pittsburgh and across the country, clearly with wealth, with race, with gender. There's even a vast gulf between urban and rural populations. And, you know, Virginia's been covering this beat so well for us for the past year and a half, and other reporters explore it regularly, but we wanted to put all of our collective energy into covering it from a variety of angles for this series.
As Patrick alluded to, Virginia, a lot of this project really falls under your regular beat of identity and justice. So what are the challenges, I should say, of reporting on inequality, a state of being that's always been or something that's not happening, not the way newsrooms might typically report on other events or ideas?
Right. I mean, it's tough because you look at the world and this beat as opposed to what's going on in education, what's going on in transportation is really just this lens to look at everything that we're dealing with. And these divides, as Patrick mentioned, really are not just black and white issues, as we often see inequities characterized in Pittsburgh. But depending on what facet of life you're looking at, the inequities fall along different lines. So one of the biggest challenges is really not stepping on other reporters' toes, right? Because there are so many inequities in early childhood education that fall directly on racial lines, or, you know, able-bodiedness that fall along transportation lines. So it really just is a way to look at the world. And you're right, sometimes it's a matter of reporting on what's not happening, but it really gives us an opportunity to tap into those things and put a specific focus on things that are really always all around us in our community.
Exactly. And I think what's interesting in our newsroom is we have kind of six focuses or beat areas. And if you were to draw like a multi-part Venn diagram, you could argue that Virginia's beat of inequity would be at the middle of that and overlaps everything. And so our other reporters were really excited to cover this area as well. And so we went to them and said, what are the stories of inequity that you want to cover? And they pitched us a bunch of ideas and we selected them and they went out and reported them.
So let's get to those stories. Virginia, let's start with you. Why did you want to focus on access to health care in rural areas, and why specifically prenatal care?
Because it's something that's really interesting that's going on right now. Healthcare is a really tremendously complicated topic. And in these rural areas that, you know, are very nearby, you don't have to go far outside of Pittsburgh or Allegheny County to find people who face tremendous challenges of access. And this is across all disciplines, not just prenatal or maternal care, right? Because it's really hard to recruit rural doctors. It's really hard to pay for treating and having emergency care for really thin, disparate, non-dense populations. Plus, it's an issue that's really not going away. Women are not going to stop having babies. And what's happening in that realm is really only going to continue. This is a trend of consolidating delivery rooms that's not got an end in sight.
Among the people you spoke with was a mom in Somerset County who feared that her local delivery room closing could mean trouble, even danger, when the baby came.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, oh my gosh, we're going to be on our way. I'm going to get to this dead zone. Baby is going to be full-fledged coming out, and I'm not going to be able to call anybody, and Brandon's going to have to deliver the baby in the car.
Yeah, Courtney Bittner was just having nightmares because her first delivery happened really, really fast. But luckily, she only had to go, you know, 15 minutes down the road as opposed to all the way up to Johnstown to deliver the baby. But what's happening is, again, if you just have one doctor on rotation, if you have so few births in an area that you just don't need more doctors, well, it's hard to get more doctors. It's hard to have an anesthesiologist. Bedford County has one pediatrician for the entire county, one. And they don't have admitting privileges to the hospital. They don't have a 24/7 on-site anesthesiologist. Like, it just gets worse and worse. So when you look at the issue, the hospitals have a very, very strong case, a very strong reason for consolidating these delivery rooms. Now you can still get your prenatal care, your regular sort of OB practice is still going to be in your local area. But when the baby comes, when it comes time, that stressful time anyways, I mean, there could be inclement weather. There's a lot of really kind of treacherous mountainous roads that happen. A lot of people can't necessarily afford to have transportation provided so quickly. So it's an issue that is really nuanced and it's kind of bittersweet. You know, women are happy to have better care potentially at these consolidated rooms, but it's scary.
Scary. Reporter Margaret J. Krause, she was on the Confluence last week talking about the recruitment of Amazon HQ2. She's exploring how people who most need and depend on transit often have the hardest time accessing it, Patrick.
Well, I think, and it echoes exactly what Virginia was talking about, the access to the transportation. It's difficult. If you have a hard time getting to work, that's going to affect your paycheck. It's going to affect your access to childcare. It's going to affect your access to go to the grocery store, find health care. It impacts every single thing in your life.
And so that does have, it touches many areas. Margaret spoke with Pamela Edwards, who lives in Brushton, and she takes two buses to get to work to downtown. She finds it to be less stressful than driving. In fact, she got rid of her car. She says her area has seen a lot of service cuts and changes, and it just can't take anymore.
But I'm just making it known that we need a bus here. Because if I don't complain, they're going to say, oh, okay, there's nobody, there's no problem. We can eliminate that bus. And that's what I think a number of people have done. They had eliminated because no one fought for the buses.
They're concerned that the proposed bus rapid transit project between downtown and Oakland and on to Greenfield could actually hurt accessibility. Fewer stops, more of an express-type service for the Braddock area and Duquesne area. So how do these irregularities or big changes to the bus system hit ridership, especially in Pittsburgh's underserved areas?
Yeah, I mean, the two Pittsburghs, man, I mean, you can't say it any better than that. These changes in anything, changes in healthcare, changes in transportation are happening for a reason, and it's because it benefits somebody. But inevitably, that means it does not benefit somebody else. And we cannot reiterate enough times what Patrick just mentioned is that transportation is like the thing, the gap. When you talk to people at development corporations or social services or schools, when this gap is there, it is going to not only be intersected with all of these other things, it's going to directly cause a gap in all of those other facets of life.
And people make their housing choices based upon transportation, right? Where their job is, where you choose to rent an apartment or buy a home, you're depending upon that bus or that highway being open. And if it changes suddenly, that is devastating.
And of course, housing is another issue in itself, affordable accessibility to affordable housing. I spoke with Mayor Peduto about inequities, and he's referred to those two Pittsburghers. He said, quote, within the city of Pittsburgh, we realize that inequity follows race, and there is very strong correlation between being Black in Pittsburgh and inequity, end quote.
Yes, sometimes it's hard to isolate what the variable is. Often we say this is a Black and white issue when really it's a socioeconomic issue or really it's an access to educational opportunities issue, but there is such a strong correlation. The median household income is much, you know, if we're talking about, you know, housing affordability, okay, African Americans have a harder time with housing affordability or finding housing that is affordable. Well, the median income is much lower. They are less likely to live with someone who has a high school diploma. They are, as we've seen in other stories, less likely. You know, there's a gap from the very beginning of their education. And so we often see things along these black and white lines because it's inevitable, because there's such strong correlation with all of these other sort of deciding factors.
Yeah, and I pulled these stats before I came on, but in 2015, blacks in the Pittsburgh area had a median household income of about $26,000. Whites were at $57,000. Mm-hmm. That's more than double. And we're not talking about home equity or anything like that. That's just household income.
And part of that reasoning might be access to quality education early on. And mm-hmm. The mayor said that one of his prime concerns, where he sees the greatest inequity, is access to early childhood, so to pre-K. Reporter Sarah Schneider looked into the achievement gap between white and black students, between middle and upper income kids and lower income kids, no matter their race. And one of the primary roots of all that, the 30 million word gap.
Just reading to the child seems to have no effect. It's reading to the child and intermittent conversation about it, not wait till the very end of a story and then ask them a question about it.
That's Isabel Beck, a retired professor who spent most of her career studying how children read, Patrick.
Right, and you know, she was trying to develop effective ways to train teachers, but parents are the child's first teacher, and that's where you see that 30 million word gap coming in. You know, children in poor families have heard 30 million fewer words than their counterparts in middle and upper income homes. Interestingly enough, what's important is not just reading to the child, but interacting with the child, engaging with them, talking about what's happening in the story.
That really speaks to how systemic all of these issues are. There's no silver bullet to close one inequity gap. And it really proves how important that they intersect, you know, with each other, and that there's this really scaffolded support. And it's just like anything else. Well, maybe you have access to a job interview, but you can't pass the drug test. Maybe you can afford the housing, but it's not on your bus line. If they don't all work together, the gaps will just persist, even if there are solutions.
And we're quickly running out of time. I want to get to another one. It has to do with the disparity in young black women involved in the criminal justice system versus their white counterparts. Patrick, Anli Herring's doing that report.
Yeah, Anli's doing this really fascinating story. According to a Heinz Endowment study from last fall, nationally, black girls are referred to juvenile court three times as often as white girls. In Allegheny County, it's 11 times more. It's a disturbing gap.
And there's another story by Kathleen Davis on food inequities, and listen to that next week. But in our remaining 1 minute, I want to say, where is this going? Is this a start of a conversation, continuation of conversation? Where do you two want this to go? Virginia, we'll start with you.
It's always going to be the conversation. And for us, it's really been the conversation for a long time. And when you look at the community, it is the conversation for them. These are people's real lives. And so we're happy to be able to sort of grant that lens that I use every day in my reporting to all of these different facets that we can focus on. Where are the gaps in education and how are they improving? Just like with transportation.
And we as a newsroom are very committed to focusing on this issue. Clearly, Virginia's done a tremendous amount of great work on this. She's going to continue to do that. And the rest of our reporters are going to continue to look at the issue of inequity in Pittsburgh, because it's not going away.
The stories continue next week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And, of course, all the reports can be found at WESA.FM. Patrick Doyle is news director at WESA. And Virginia Alvino Young is WESA's identity and justice reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance and research from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.